Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Saru Jayaraman. Saru is an attorney, author, and activist who is dedicated to improving wages and working conditions for restaurant workers. She's the co-founder and co-director of Restaurant Opportunities Centers United and serves as the director of the Food Labor Research Center at University of California at Berkeley. Saru was listed in CNN's Top 10 Visionary Women. She's been recognized as a champion of change by the White House, and she was awarded the James Beard Foundation Leadership Award. She is author of Behind the Kitchen Door and Forked, A New Standard for American Dining. She's showing us that the women who put food on the tables of restaurant goers everywhere are often struggling to put it on their own, and she's working to change that. Saru, we're so appreciative of your critically important work and so grateful for this time with you. Now, for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Saru, for being with us again.
Good to be here.
You know, a lot of people today, I'm sure many of our listeners, are rebelling against the standard American diet. They're choosing organic food. They're demanding that GMOs be labeled. They're deploring the terrible treatment of animals in factory farms. They're calling for fundamental changes in how we grow and how we process and how we think about our food. But it seems that the hardships and the working conditions of restaurant workers have somehow not been given nearly as much attention. Why have you made it your mission to expose this truth, and why is it critically important for all of us to become aware of it?
Well, me personally, I just can't think of a more important thing to think about right now. You know, for anybody who cares about food or eating or the survival of our nation, first it should be known that there are 20 million workers in the U.S. food system, 12 million of which are in the restaurant industry. As a sector, the food system is the largest employer of any private sector employer in the United States, and the restaurant industry alone is the second largest private sector employer in the United States. And unfortunately, both the restaurant industry alone and the food system as a whole, despite its like size and growth, are both the absolute lowest paying employers in the United States. So what does that mean? You've got the largest and fastest growing sectors, the food system as a whole, and restaurants in particular, proliferating the absolute lowest paying jobs in the United States. Every year, the U.S. Department of Labor puts out a list of the 10 lowest paying jobs. Every year, 7 of the 10 are restaurant jobs, and the 8th lowest paying job is farm work. And so 8 of the 10 lowest paying jobs in the United States are food system jobs. And so there will be no GDP or food system to talk about as we grow the low-wage floor of the economy, the food system essentially perpetuates the inability of workers in the food system to be able to afford to eat. I mean, right now, 1 in 3 working Americans works full-time and lives in poverty. By 2021 or 2022, it's expected that 1 in 2 working Americans will work full-time or more and live in poverty. And that growth is due almost entirely to the growth in the restaurant industry and the food system. You have to ask yourself, when half of the nation can't afford to eat, what will happen to our GDP? Who will afford to eat the food that we grow?
You've pointed out elsewhere that restaurant servers are 3 times as likely to live in poverty compared to the rest of the U.S. workforce.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think one thing most people don't know is that the federal minimum wage for servers and other tipped workers in the United States is still $2.13 an hour. It's been stuck there for 26 years. And perhaps people have memories of their own experience being a server, because 1 in 2 of us has worked in this industry at some point in our lifetime. And maybe for some of us who are educated, our memories of being a server in high school, college, or graduate school are we made a lot of money as servers. But in fact, the millions of women, mostly women, who work as servers, the majority of servers in America are women, 70% of them, and the majority work in places like IHOP and Denny's and Applebee's and Olive Garden. Their median wage is about $8.50 an hour. And as you said, they suffer from 3 times the poverty rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce and use food stamps at double the rate. So I come back to the question, when the largest and fastest growing industry is proliferating jobs in which people must rely on food stamps to survive, who will afford to eat the food in the food system that people care about? If we care about a sustainable food system, how could we not think about sustainable wages and working conditions for the people in it if we expect the food system to survive or grow?
Before I read your books, I assumed that restaurant servers were paid for their jobs. I assumed the costs of service were built into the menu price. So I have to admit this, in a few cases where I thought the server was rude, or maybe I was just in an irritable mood, I am embarrassed now to say that I left little or no tip. I had no idea, honestly, that wages for tipped workers in the U.S. are as low as they are, that they range between $213 an hour and about $5 an hour in 41 states. And I didn't know that when you're a tipped worker who receives that much money as a wage, you don't actually receive a wage. Your wage is so small that it goes entirely to fees and taxes, and you sometimes get a pay stub with $0. I really had no idea that the vast majority of tipped workers in this country live completely off their tips. It's a little embarrassing to admit that, and I'm ashamed to admit that, but I'm glad to know. Sarah, can you explain how tipping really works?
Yeah, and you're not alone. Most Americans have no idea that the federal minimum wage is $2.13 an hour, or that these workers are really mostly living off the whims and caprices of customers. So how does tipping actually work? Tipping actually originated in feudal Europe. It was a vestige of the feudal system, noblesse oblige, something that an aristocrat gave to a serf or vassal or servant, always on top of the wage. When it came to the States, it was because of rich Americans traveling to Europe and coming back and trying to show off that they knew the rules of Europe. So they came back in the 1850s and 1860s, and when they did and tried to tip, there was actually a massive populist anti-tipping movement at the turn of the 19th century in which Americans said, this is undemocratic, it's a vestige of the feudal system, we reject it. And in fact, that movement spread to Europe, and the labor movement picked it up in Europe, which is why now there's very little tipping in Europe, because people say that's a feudal concept and we're professionals and don't tip us. Here in the States, we went in the exact opposite direction because the restaurant industry at the time demanded the right to hire newly freed slaves and not pay them anything at all and let them live on customer tips. And that idea that a former slave could be paid $0 an hour as long as tips brought them to the minimum wage lasted until this day, when we went from $0 in 1938 to a whopping $2.13 an hour in 2017. And over that 80-year time period, essentially the industry has argued that, I should say, the restaurant association, the trade lobby, has argued that it's okay, these are white guys working in fancy fine dining steakhouses, they're making $50 an hour in tips, there's no reason to give them a wage. When, as I said, in fact, the vast majority, 70% of these workers are women, mostly single moms, struggling to survive, feeding their families on tips, and actually suffering from the worst sexual harassment of any industry in the United States, precisely because they are having to basically please the customer. I mean, it was no fault of your own that you didn't know that this system existed, and so sometimes you don't tip, sometimes you do tip because you don't know. But that fact that you tip sometimes and you don't sometimes is precisely the problem. Tips should be, as they were in feudal Europe, always on top of a wage, so that the pleasure or displeasure of a customer is not what is determining whether a woman can feed her family. No, it should be a symbol of pleasure or displeasure on top of a wage that a woman is using to actually feed her family.
You know, when I hear you say that the restaurant industry is where more sexual harassment takes place than any other industry in the country, I wonder, and can I ask you to explain what this means in reality for the 7% of American women who today are working in the restaurant industry?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked, because it's the issue that really makes me the most sad and passionate about this issue as a woman and the mother of two little girls. Most of us have daughters. Many of us have daughters for whom this will be the first job in high school, college, or graduate school. And this is how we are introducing women to the world of work, because it is a largely female workforce that works in this industry for their lifetimes, about 6 million women who work in this industry throughout their lives, but millions more for whom this is the first job. And this is how they learn what's acceptable, tolerable, ethical in the workplace. And it's an environment in which management is essentially telling you wear tighter clothing, show more cleavage, dress more sexy in order to make more money and tips. If you want to actually have a decent income here, it doesn't come from doing better on in the job so that your employer pays you more. No, because your employer doesn't pay you hardly anything at all. It comes from pleasing the customer. And there's such a fine line between having to do things that really border on sexual harassment, in many cases sexual assault, like basically being told to show more of your body or to flirt or to touch the customer or allow yourself to be touched or grabbed or worse. When you're encouraged in these ways by your manager and told you will make more money in tips, you will do better in this job, you'll be a better worker if you allow yourself to be subjected to this kind of harassment, that's how you end up with the highest rates of sexual harassment of any industry in the United States. It's the largest industry. And as you said, 7% of American women work in it, but a full 37% of all sexual harassment complaints to the EEOC, the Equal Opportunities Commission, come from this one industry, the restaurant industry.
A moment ago, you mentioned Olive Garden. Olive Garden's parent company is Darden. It's the nation's largest casual restaurant company. It has something like $6 billion in sales annually. Their slogan is, when you're here, you're family. Saru, does the way the company treats its workers, and particularly its female workers, strike you as family-friendly?
It strikes me as a particularly dysfunctional family if it's a family. In my latest book, Forked, A New Standard for American Dining, I tell the story of a young woman in an Indiana Olive Garden who earned $2.13 an hour, which is the wage in Indiana, and struggled a lot. Single mom. She said her mom had earned $2.13 an hour as a waitress, and since the wage has been frozen for 26 years, she's earning the same. Couldn't survive with her son, had to move in back with her mother. But the worst part, besides all the struggles of not being able to feed her child or pay the rent, was a manager in the restaurant who was notorious for grabbing women and touching them, grabbing them, putting his hand down their pants. And women who complained at the Olive Garden were pretty summarily fired, let go. And it's funny because they claim to have a zero tolerance policy, and we joke and rock that it's a zero tolerance for complaining about sexual harassment, zero tolerance for any kind of complaints about sexual harassment. In this worker's case, she ended up having to tolerate it. And as a young woman, what does that mean when you're basically told, don't complain about it, this is part of the job, if you do, you'll get fired? Again, it means that whatever you end up doing later on, if you stay in the industry or you go to something else, this basically sets the standard so that, you know, I've gone on tour a lot. I write books and I go on book tour and give talks around the country, and women invariably come up to me in these book talks and say, you know, I'm now a lawyer, doctor, organizer, teacher, executive. I've been sexually harassed in my current job, but I didn't do anything about it because it was never as bad as it was when I was a young woman working in restaurants, which means that, again, our daughters, whether they stay in this industry or just go through it in high school, college, or graduate school, they will be exposed to this culture of work in which they are told that their worth is based on their ability to get a man to want to grab them. I mean, so much so that when that video came up during the campaign of Donald Trump bragging that he had grabbed women, we had servers write to us from all over the country and say, you know what, that happens to me every single day. A man walks into the restaurant, grabs me in various parts of my body, a customer, and I'm told by my manager not only to put up with it, but frankly, the more that that man wants to grab me, the better worth I am in the restaurant.
Wow, that is so striking. You know, it seems to me that you are expanding our definition of what sustainable food means. I mean, most of us think of it meaning food grown without pesticides, or we think of livestock that are raised humanely without hormones or antibiotics. We think of locally sourced foods that are healthy for our bodies and the earth. But if we're going to eat mindfully, we can't be selectively conscious. And I think we have to ask, how sustainable is it to eat food that's served to us by workers who cannot afford to feed their own families? And how sustainable is food that's brought to us by women who undergo the kind of sexual harassment routinely that you're describing?
It's so true. And unfortunately, restaurants that do provide locally sourced, organic, sustainable cuisine are not any different from the rest of the industry. Now, there are definitely standout restaurants. We've created a list and a guide of restaurants that are treating their workers well and paying them well and are working with us to change policy on these issues. They are part of an association called RAISE of restaurants taking what we call the high road to profitability. But the vast majority of restaurants in this country simply follow the standards set by the chains in terms of wages and working conditions. And unfortunately, we have found that is also true for restaurants that serve local organic and sustainable cuisine. In fact, at one point, we did a survey of restaurant workers in different kinds of restaurants and found actually that food insecurity was greater among restaurants who said they worked in restaurants that served locally sourced organic cuisine than it was in other restaurants. So I don't think sustainable restaurants are worse in terms of the traditional definition of sustainable food. I don't think restaurants that serve quote-unquote sustainable cuisine are worse necessarily. I just think that they tend to follow the exact same standards. And it's up to us as consumers who care about anything sustainable, sustainable food, a sustainable world, a sustainable business model, sustainable dining experiences, but up to us to let employers know that it's not enough for them to serve us a beautiful, expensive meal with locally sourced organic tomatoes. We have to know that the people bringing us that food, cooking that food, serving that food are treated well. Otherwise, our desire to eat sustainably is really impacted.
You know, I want to play devil's advocate for a moment with all respect. I've spoken to some people who own and run small family restaurants. They're dealing with serious financial challenges. They're having a hard time staying in business. And they want to do the right thing for their workers. Now, one of them told me that they have restaurant customers who come in and who claim to be for changes in restaurants that result in paying fairer wages and higher wages. But as soon as they see any hike in the prices as a result of wage increases, they immediately, I was told, forget their lofty talk and take to Yelp to complain. So, Saru, do you have any advice for these folks who are running these small family restaurants?
Yeah, join forces with us. We've got a whole training and technical assistance program to help restaurant owners figure out how to move to higher wages and actually still be very profitable. In fact, not in spite of treating workers well, but actually because you're treating workers well. I think the part most employers don't realize, most customers don't realize, is that when you treat your workers well, pay them well, our data shows you can cut your turnover, employee turnover in half in an industry that has some of the highest employee turnover rates of any industry in the U.S. You have higher productivity, higher profitability, happier servers, happier customers. There's just so many added benefits to investing in your workforce the way you might invest in the quality of the food or the ambiance. If you invest in the people, you're going to see a real payoff. In fact, Danny Meyer, who I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with, fine dining legend Danny Meyer, who owns Union Square Hospitality Group and started Shake Shack, you know, one of his, you know, principles that he puts out in his book, Setting the Table, is that the first order of business is to take care of your workers. They are your front lines. They are the ones who sell. And you will do well as a business if you treat your workers well. Now, he's a large, fancy fine dining restaurant owner, and the smaller restaurants you're talking about may not have the same market that he does. But I will tell you, the majority of restaurants that have joined forces with us and worked with us to raise wages and bring their customers along as they raise wages have been small mom-and-pop restaurants that have worked with us to figure it out. Part of what they figure out is you don't actually have to see huge price increases by raising wages. There are ways to do it without huge price increases. And if there are any, I would say, moderate or small price increases, we have a consumer association called Diners United, and we're really working with restaurants to educate consumers about why these changes need to happen.
I hear you making the case that a restaurant culture that takes employees very, very seriously, and it may be even an employee-first restaurant culture, is not just the right thing to do from a human rights perspective, from a human decency perspective, but it also can lead to more sustainable and more profitable business outcomes.
Absolutely.
You know, it's When I think about that, I think it's most likely to work at a high-end private restaurant, least likely to work in a national chain. But it seems that Chipotle, which also, by the way, is leading the way with some new animal welfare practices for chicken suppliers, has also taken the lead in some respects in treating employees better. Is that true?
It is. I mean, there's still things we'd love to see Chipotle do, and this is why we call what we call our businesses that work with us on the high road. It's not a destination. Nobody is perfect, nor is anybody completely evil. It's a road along which the employers that work with us are traveling, the high road in which they are trying consistently to do better by their workers. So I think there's definitely more things we'd love to see Chipotle do, but there's some extraordinary things they're already doing that we like to lift up. You know, they do have much better mobility for their workers and advancement ladder, career ladders than other chains. They have committed to providing paid sick days and paid family leave to their workers. They are open to conversation about what more they can do. All of that speaks volumes to the fact that I think they are open to the idea that when they invest in their workforce, that you see payoffs over time. And I don't know about other people's experiences, but I certainly have. I have noticed the difference in just observing chains in terms of workers telling us how much happier they are at Chipotle than other places. And certainly when I go there, I see that in the way that I'm treated. But I think ultimately what Chipotle is showing and what we've been able to show through all the different companies that are part of our network is that this kind of change is possible regardless of the kind of restaurant you are, whether you're small or large, fine dining or fast food. It is totally possible to make changes. Not only are the restaurants, individual restaurant companies showing that, but state policy is showing that. You know, California has had higher wages than most other states for a long time. We just went to $15 minimum wage as a state. California has the largest and fastest growing industry in the United States, restaurant industry. We actually have a full 1 million of the 12 million workers in the United States are right here in California. And actually, Los Angeles has a larger restaurant industry than New York City. Los Angeles is a city. So it's just also borne out by the data that not only can restaurants of all kinds figure this out, but in states that have higher wages, we see restaurants of all kinds. They actually are figuring it out, whether they're in Fresno or they're in Bakersfield or they're in LA or the Bay Area, whether they're a small restaurant or a chain. Restaurants are figuring it out and booming in the state of California.
One of the reasons that it's so important for restaurants to figure this out, one of the many reasons, came to my mind when you mentioned that Chipotle is one of their positive steps is they're providing paid 6 days. I mean, to me, that should be a given, but I know it's not in the industry as a whole. And when workers are paid so little, when they receive no paid sick days and often no health benefits, I would think they would have a very strong incentive to work even if they're sick. And would that then pose a health risk to diners?
Oh, it's more than a health risk. That's an understatement. 90% of restaurant workers in America don't have a single paid sick day. 2/3 report cooking, preparing, and serving our food when they are ill. And we've documented everything. Workers working with H1N1. I had a worker testify in the Florida State Legislature that she worked at a very fine dining restaurant in Miami Beach for 3 weeks with typhoid fever. We've seen just horrible outbreaks. In fact, the Center for Disease Control reports that 50 to 90% of all norovirus outbreaks can be traced back to sick restaurant workers. And if you don't know what norovirus is, you don't want to know. It's called the winter stomach flu. It's really miserable. I've had it. And it really comes from restaurant workers being sick on the job because they're forced to, not because they want to. But when you earn $2.13 an hour and you live on tips, there's only one way to earn those tips. It's to show up at work. Not to mention that for a lot of kitchen staff, they're basically told they'll be fired if they don't come, regardless of how sick they are. So this is a public health crisis. It's not just people making us sick. This is a public health crisis. And we have seen in many cities that are beginning to pass legislation requiring this industry to provide paid sick days. It's still not the majority, but a number of cities have started to do this. We have started to see a reduction in illness outbreaks as a result in these workers being provided paid sick days. So you know, I think a lot of your listeners, any of whom have experienced any kind of sickness after eating out, you have to understand that's not necessarily just what we call food poisoning. Most of the time that comes from the fact that this industry, I've heard an industry professional and an employer actually kind of say with jokingly, oh, we take full credit for the winter flu. We know that we're the ones who perpetuate the winter flu because everybody's working when they're sick. So if the industry acknowledges it, I think that we as a public have to really stand up and say, this is a crisis and I refuse to subject my family or my loved ones. I want to eat out, but I refuse to subject my family to this. We have to pass legislation that requires paid sick days.
I agree, and I'm sure many of our listeners do. And this is so important. I mean, spending at restaurants in the U.S. has been slowly but steadily approaching the amounts we spend at grocery stores, and now it has actually surpassed it.
Yeah,
Americans are now spending more at restaurants than on groceries.
Yeah, we eat out more than anybody else on Earth with greater frequency, and actually that number just continues to explode. I mean, I've been working on these issues for 15 years, and just over the last 3 years in my talks and speeches and writing, I've gone from saying the industry has a little over 10 million, a little over 11 million. Last fall, we hit the 12 million worker mark. The industry is just exploding, and it's because we keep eating out in ever-increasing numbers with increasing frequency, more than anybody else on Earth. And so we, I don't think that's anything to be ashamed of. I think we as Americans tend to celebrate our culture in restaurants, special moments, wonderful moments. I think that restaurants have become the gathering places, the community spaces for America. And that is okay as long as in those community spaces we are taking care of our people and making sure that everybody is thriving, including the people who are bringing us our food.
There's a political issue today regarding undocumented workers. And as we all know, the undocumented workers are behind a lot of the food we eat in this country, picking it, harvesting it, working in restaurants. According to government figures, 20% of those working in food service jobs, which includes waiting tables and washing dishes and other restaurant and food prep jobs, are unauthorized immigrants. But those kinds of government figures are almost certainly underreported because people are often reluctant and understandably to answer questions about immigration status. One estimate that I saw is that twice as many unauthorized immigrants work in food service as do U.S.-born workers. Saru, what would happen to restaurants if undocumented or unauthorized immigrants were no longer available to work in them?
Yeah, this industry was already going through the worst labor shortage in the history of this industry before the election of November 2016. We were already experiencing a very painful labor shortage that was actually driving some positive change in some ways. The industry was having to start to think about how to pay people more, how to retain them. And then you have rhetoric now and potential policy that could get rid of these workers, the industry is just going through a crisis. The most conservative numbers are the ones you've given. Some people say out of 12 million, at least 1.3 million are undocumented, double that for all immigrants. But in cities like Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, the Bay Area, I mean, just all over the country, you're talking closer to, our estimates are that it's closer to 45 or even 50% of all workers in those cities that are in this industry are undocumented, which means the industry would absolutely shut down. It would absolutely shut down if these workers were not present. So I really think it has to be understood that people in power right now who are talking about deporting these workers actually employ thousands of undocumented immigrants themselves. I'm sure everybody knows that those red Make America Great Again hats were actually made by undocumented workers in Los Angeles. So the people in power, I don't believe, are actually interested in deporting 11 million undocumented immigrants. They are interested in creating a climate of fear in which workers do not feel that they can speak up for their rights or when they're exploited or when they're not properly paid, do not feel that they have the right to speak up. And frankly, that inability to speak up then drives down wages for everybody, not just for immigrants, because certainly unscrupulous employers will prefer workers who don't speak up. and you're going to see a driving down of wages across the board. So fundamentally, it has to be understood that the current rhetoric about deporting these workers is actually not about immigration policy, it's labor policy and trying to drive down wages and trying to keep people quiet. That is really what it's about, and the industry, it will suffer tremendously if any of this is actually implemented.
It seems, honestly, that without immigrants, the restaurant industry wouldn't even exist.
Oh, absolutely. Not just the workers, but I'm sure your listeners know. I mean, so much of the growth in the restaurant industry is entirely immigrants. So much of the new cuisine and the fusion cuisine and even the impacts on what we call American cuisine really comes from immigrants. And there have just been so many tremendous contributions to this industry and really in ways that have changed our industry for the better. So it wouldn't just kill the industry. It wouldn't just shut it down. It would be a huge setback in terms of the growth and diversification of this industry that I don't know if the industry could survive if those kinds of policies were actually implemented.
You know, as we're having this conversation, I'm wondering what steps our listeners, what steps the average restaurant goers can take to help workers. I mean, obviously we can tip better. That's the decent thing to do, but that's clearly not enough. If we want to help create industry-wide systemic change in working conditions, So, Saru, are there other ways, even small ways, that we can advocate for restaurant workers every time that we eat out, every time we go to a restaurant?
Absolutely. I'm so glad you asked. So we have a website on our, or a sub-site on our website called Diners United. It's an association online of consumers that have signed up and said, I want to know which restaurants are treating their workers well. I want to get engaged. Since the election, 11,000 consumers have signed on. And basically, through that site, dinersunited.org, you can download an app on your phone. Actually, it's a mobile site on your phone that tells you how restaurants are faring on issues of wages, benefits, and promotions. If a restaurant in your area is not listed there, or if it is, the point of the app is actually not to tell you where to eat and where not to eat. It's to give you a tool when you eat out to either tell the employer, love the food, love the service, I love it that I see you ranked really well in this guide, or to say, I don't see you in this guide, or I don't see you ranked well in this guide. I come here regularly, and I would really like to see you do well in this guide and encourage the restaurant owner to contact us, to become a part of our Association of High Road Restaurants, and to have their information listed in our guide, or to work with us to improve their wages and benefits. So, certainly, if you have that mobile app, you can, at the end of your meal, speak to the employer, the manager, the owner, not to the workers, because you could get them in trouble and say to the manager, owner, love the food here, love the service. I would love to see you do well in this guide. Can you contact this group and either figure out how to do better or get your already great information listed in this guide? That's one thing people can do. There's another thing in this moment, actually, that people can do, which is that after the election, many of our restaurant owners created something called sanctuary restaurants, which was not about harboring undocumented immigrants, but it was about creating what they call a safe place at the table for everyone, an environment free of hate, an inclusive environment in which all immigrants, Muslims, LGBTQ people, workers, customers, women can find a harassment-free environment. And many restaurants, at this point, 400 restaurants have signed on to become sanctuary restaurants and have put the placards and stickers up in their windows. And so, again, you can go to the sanctuaryrestaurants.org website. You can sign up as a consumer. You can download little cards that you can give restaurant owners every time you eat out, encouraging them to sign on as sanctuary restaurants. You can also download cards you can give workers with a mobile text number that allows workers to text in anytime they're facing any kind of harassment or attack and get support from our legal department as to what they can do. So there's a lot consumers can do. You can go to dinersunited.org or sanctuaryrestaurants.org, and please do it. Get engaged and speak up when you eat out.
Thank you very much for your work in that regard. It's very heartwarming and it's inspiring.
Thank you.
It's galvanizing, and it's desperately needed. I wish it wasn't so desperately needed, but it is, and you're there to provide it. You know, I read your most recent book, Forked, and one of the things I enjoyed while I was reading it was the stories you tell of enlightened restaurant owners who treat and pay workers decently and who get immediate returns, both in employee loyalty, but also in better customer service and in profits. And I was particularly impressed with what you revealed about the celebrity chef, Tom Colicchio.
Yeah, we've been very impressed with Tom's restaurants over the years in terms of the racial equity and the racial diversity in his very fine dining restaurants. You know, one of the other issues that we work on is pretty severe racial segregation in the restaurant industry. It's pretty normalized for a lot of, I think, your listeners. It has been for a long time in America that in a fine dining restaurant, you're going to see white servers and sommeliers and bartenders and people of color as bussers and runners and kitchen staff. And the differential in wages can sometimes be a 5 times differential between a fine dining server or bartender and a busser, runner, or kitchen staff. And so not only do we need to raise wages for all of these workers and what we call lift the floor, but we also need to build the ladder so that regardless of their skin color, a worker can advance to be a sommelier. You know, we just had a young man of color from Washington, D.C. become a master of wine. There are only 75 masters of wine in the world, 2 of whom are people of color, 1 of whom is our guy. And so it's totally possible for there to be career ladders in this industry, but real issues of implicit bias, what's known as implicit bias on the part of all of us, including employers and consumers, has kept workers from being seen as potentials for servers, bartenders, or sommeliers, or wine experts. And so Tom has had a different model. He just, you know, through intentionality, has had people of color in very high-level positions in his fine dining restaurants. And we're helping more restaurants in all over the country actually figure out how to do the same, how to diversify. Because ultimately, I think we do want to see all of these restaurants be less segregated, more reflective of the populations that they're in, really promoting that idea of racial equity, particularly in this moment when so many of these ideas of equity and diversity are under attack. I think we as customers can stand up to see that in these places that we eat out.
When you mention these racial issues, you know, I've noticed that when I've eaten in restaurants, usually the workers in the front, the people who serve the customers, are lighter skinned. Those in the back, hidden in the kitchen, are darker skinned. And I've also assumed, and I want to ask you if this is accurate, I've assumed, maybe perceived, that Black servers get tipped less, even if the customers are Black. Is that true?
Oh, it's absolutely true. There's been studies that have come out of the Cornell School of Hospitality Management on tipping that show that tipping, unfortunately, has nothing to do with the quality of service. All of us, you know, a lot of servers think that they get tipped more because they serve really well, and I'm sure they are professionals who serve very well. And like other professionals, they should be rewarded for that by their employer. But tipping generally does not reflect quality of service. Data shows it reflects your race, your gender, your skin color, your eye color, your hair color. If you're a woman, you get tipped more if you touch the customer. If you're a man, you get tipped less if you touch the customer. Unfortunately, with women, of course, tips are highly correlated with these issues we talked about earlier, sexual harassment and body type and attractiveness to the customer. So there's some real pernicious ways in which tips are reflecting the real ills in our society in terms of racism and sexism and misogyny that could somewhat be reduced if we could ensure, as California and 6 other states do, that these workers get an actual wage from their employer and let tips be what they were always meant to be, even in feudal Europe, just an extra, a gratuity, something gratis, something extra on top of a wage that guarantees that every worker, regardless of their skin color, breast size or height or eye color, can actually feed their families.
I remember a couple of years ago, the governor of New York was proposing a minimum wage of $15 an hour, which would be a good thing. But I think he was exempting from that tipped workers.
That's right. Unfortunately, when the wage went to 15 last year, for everybody else, 400,000 tipped workers were left out and, in fact, saw their work wages decline in New York State. That was the deal struck with the restaurant association that tipped workers would see their wages go down while everybody else saw their wages go up. And so we are now moving legislation in the New York State Legislature that would correct that and get tipped workers also to $15, as is in this case in California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska for the last 40 years have all had the same wage for tipped and non-tipped workers for decades. And actually, those seven states are faring better on every measure than the 43 states with lower wages for tipped workers, higher restaurant sales per capita, higher job growth in the industry, even higher rates of tipping. Alaskans actually tip better than anybody else in the United States, and they have had the same wage for tipped and non-tipped workers for decades. And you see half the rate of sexual harassment because their tips are not what actually women have to survive on. Tips are an extra on top of the wage.
Well, they're models, I think, for the direction we all want to see the industry go. And Saru, for the last 15 years or more, your organization, ROC, has been leading successful campaigns against the exploitation of restaurant workers. You've won back tens of millions of dollars in tips and wages that had been stolen from workers. You've helped to bring about policy changes that have improved the lives of many, many, many thousands of people whose work too often goes unnoticed and unrewarded in the restaurant industry. I really appreciate what you're doing, what you have been doing, what you're going to keep doing. It's a privilege to speak with you and to bring your vitally important message to our listeners. On behalf of myself and of Ocean and of everyone involved in the food revolution, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for your tireless work. And of course, I want to thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Good to talk.
We've been talking with Saru Jayaraman, co-founder of the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United and author of Behind the Kitchen Door and Forked. Saru, your message is disturbing and agitating in the best possible way. It's a service to restaurant workers and their families, obviously, but it's also a service to everybody who eats and everybody who wants a fair and decent and healthy society. We want to thank you for your time, for your wisdom, for your vital work, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you so much.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.